Whether you work in institutional capital or private equity, whether you're interested in asset-backed securities, ABS that is, or commercial mortgage-backed securities, aka CMBS, or other areas of the real estate capital markets, this corner of the business can be a hard language to translate. The state of play is complex and has endured a prolonged period of change. On this episode, we dig into the fundamentals of funds and the state of commercial real estate investment with informed perspectives that have been shaped by history and are active and influential in the business right now.
You know, it's a bit of a Charles Dickens market right now, right? For some, it's not too bad, or perhaps even pretty good. And for some, they're just trying to get their head above the waterline.
That's Bob Ritchie, Senior Managing Director at Lone Star Funds, which manages 23 private equity funds with aggregate capital commitments totaling approximately $87 billion. Bob's a 35-year veteran of the real estate capital world, joining Lone Star in 2009 on the heels of the global financial crisis. He's now responsible for Lone Star's commercial real estate investments across North America.
If you're one of those deep-pocketed sponsors that has a lot of wherewithal, you're feeling quite better about the markets and the depth of the market and liquidity and the cost of capital compared to where we were just 12 months ago.
And that's Tom Rugg, co-head of U.S. Large Loans at CBRE within Debt and Structured Finance. Tom has been on both sides of the coin, so to speak, joining the company last year after spending the previous two decades on the lending side at banks such as Deutsche Bank, Wells Fargo, and Wachovia, where, incidentally, he and Bob were once colleagues. Coming up, another conversation in which we follow the money. We're talking funds and investing in commercial real estate. I'm Spencer Levy, and that's right now on The Weekly Take. Welcome to The Weekly Take, and I'm delighted to be speaking with our very own Tom Rugg. Tom, thanks for coming out.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
And then our old friend, Bob Ritchie. Bob, great to see you.
Thanks, Spence. It's great to be here. Thank you.
You bet. So let's just start big picture, Tom. I think there's been no segment of our business that's gotten more scrutiny in the last couple of years in the debt capital markets, in large part because of rising interest rates and sticky inflation. From your perspective, what's going on?
2022 and 2023 were difficult years for the financing markets. This, of course, was led by rising interest rates. This really dampened less lender demand and investor appetite. What we saw as recently as Q4 was a shift in tone from the Federal Reserve. There was a pause in rate hikes, and this created and generated increased liquidity and demand for paper. As a result of that, we've seen a stabilizing market in terms of borrowing costs, increasing demand, and a cost of capital which has improved. Today's interest rates are 50 to 60 basis points tighter than they were 6 months ago. The sources of capital are varied. There is life insurance company capital available. There is debt fund capital available. There is insurance company capital available. The GSEs are open for multifamily assets. So the markets simply feel much healthier, more robust, and we are on a path towards a much healthier capital markets.
So, Bob, how do you see the market today?
You know, it's a bit of a Charles Dickens market right now, right? For some, it's not too bad, or perhaps even pretty good. And for some, they're just trying to get their head above the waterline. The first category are largely institutional investors, right? Certainly all your REITs and a lot of your better capitalized institutional borrowers that either finance long-term or never had as much debt. For the other side of the market, and it's certainly smaller, but it's still significant. There are many borrowers that were buying when cap rates were at close to all-time lows, and they were putting in close to all-time high debt levels, and they were using short maturity debt. And many times they didn't hedge it because when would rates ever go up, right? And all of that changed. So the temptation is to characterize commercial real estate with a tagline. And that's always incorrect, and it certainly is now. So I think for the part of the market that works, meaning you're above water and you size to the current debt requirements, it's pretty darn good because you're seeing that in the CMBS SASB market, right? The volume's up almost 400% from year to date last year. But if you don't, your head is at or below water, you can't finance your way out, you can't sell your way out, and you're in a pickle. And that's the part of the market where the commentary is directed at. Many times it's mislabeled all of it, but it's a significant and it's a fairly large part of the market.
So, Bob, let me take a step back for a second. Just tell us who Lone Star is. What do you do?
Sure. So Lone Star is a private equity firm that's been successfully investing for over 30 years. We operate funds in commercial real estate, traditional corporate private equity, and residential mortgage loans and securities. Our funds are typically closed-end. And what sets us apart, or if you ask us what are the differentiators of Lone Star, I'd say, one, we have a strong, dedicated affiliate asset manager, Hudson Advisors, which allows us to underwrite and execute our business plans. Two, we have the ability to pursue debt or equity across commercial real estate sectors. So we have a fairly flexible mandate. Three, we have a global reach. So we never face the conundrum of having to invest in a particular market when the opportunities don't avail themselves in that particular market.
Capital plays an increasingly important role in the markets as well, Bob. Given the pullback from the REITs, from the core funds, substantial dry powder has been raised by the funds to buy assets given the market dislocation, as well as the repricing of commercial real estate, which is happening real time. In my opinion, many funds are in a terrific position in today's market to buy great assets that reflect a discount to peak values, and that includes Lone Star and your stellar team.
When we talk about Lone Star and your ability to do equity or debt, today sometimes it's preferred equity, sometimes it's best. Sometimes it's a little gray what it is. Do you have separate funds for debt and equity? Or you all
No, it's all within our fund. And you're right. In fact, we have trouble sometimes characterizing whether an opportunity is straight debt or whether it's equity. How does one characterize a lender-facilitated short sale? It's clearly got a debt problem, and the equity is certainly impaired. So, I don't know, is it debt? Is that equity? It's yes. It's the opportunity. And I think this period we're in right now, when the market gets churned up, the neat delineations blur, right? And we're in there, right? The trick is to be able to pursue those investments, right, that are compelling, however you wish to categorize them. But it's certainly born out of, I think, debt problems and valuation problems right now.
The market has had a strong resurgence in terms of capital and demand for liquidity and depth in the market. When you're talking about a large syndicated bank deal, that is not available in today's market. On the flip side, there's been a strong resurgence in the capital markets in the CMBS market. And I can give you a few statistics regarding that. The CMBS market, if you're looking at year-to-date CMBS issuance, and I'm talking about non-agency, non-CLO, is approximately $39.6 billion year-to-date. That's roughly three times more than this was in 2023, which was $13 billion. Of that $39 billion, approximately $28 billion, or 72%, has been single-asset, single-borrower deals. These are the large securitized deals. The remaining 28%, or $11 billion, has been conduit. That really speaks to the resurgence of the large loan market, particularly in CMBS. In terms of what is that comprised of, industrial portfolios are dominating the CMBS SASB market, 10 deals totaling over $10 billion, or 37% of SASB issued to date. Also hotels, both single assets and portfolios, have had strong issuance as well. Year to date, 17 deals totaling approximately $8 billion. That's 28% of the SASB issued to date. Between industrial and hotels, that's 65% of the market year to date.
I just want to circle back to my Charles Dickens state of the market. I enjoyed the thought of that. But to dig a little deeper, the CMB, the commercial real estate finance market's about $4.7 trillion, right? Number we know. Loans are typically plus or minus about 7 years. Banks a little shorter, the GSE is a little longer, life is a little longer, they average about seven. So your run rate of maturities is something around $700 billion a year. Last year, 200 billion of the 700 didn't pay off on time, right? Because they couldn't. So this year's maturity are 900 billion. So what does that mean? So you're starting to get a bit of a stack up, not from the good side of the market, they're the ones that are repaying, from the ones that can't, right, or don't want to, or the bank doesn't want, or they're doing something, it's an overtime, right, trying to figure it out. You're going to continue to see that push, right? Where does it go? Well, to date, through May, 63% of loans that have matured have repaid. That's down from about mid-70s last year. So that is part of the decay I'm talking about, right? It's about 10 points less successful, worse. The biggie that you touched on, office. How's office doing? Year to date, 36% of office loans that were to mature and have matured have successfully repaid or refinanced, 36. Broad market, 63. Clearly doing poorly, but not surprising, right? Everyone knows offices got issues. But where was office in 23? It was 53%. Where was it in 22? Over 90. So the financing markets, like Tom, the good side, right, that Tom was talking about that I alluded to, full on, wide open, especially CMBS, a lot of capital, spread tightening, all that stuff, volumes up, yes. But if you're not that, if you don't work, you don't size, you're in a conundrum, right? You're not refinancing and you're trying to find your way. Your lender didn't want the property back. And if you're an underwater borrower, how much capital are you going to put? You can't put any capital in. You already lost it, or most of it. So this is what I refer to as the finality of default. Like, these problems can be kicked. We saw it in GFC, the great financial crisis, right? We all lived through it. It took several years. Lenders didn't want them back. Borrowers didn't want to, like, let them go. But then the ultimate determinant of how these get resolved many times, the finality of default, how I think about it, when capital is needed. And commercial real estate is one of the most capital-consuming asset classes there are. It always requires capital. When it comes time to put that in, another underwater borrower, they're not putting it in. A lender, oh, they're not putting it in. They're in lending business. They're not in. And that's where it breaks. We're not fully there yet, but that finality of default is, you're starting to see it. And that's what needs to happen to start to have loans, clear market, whether they're going to default, get restructured. I think we're really starting to get into that. And I think second half of this year, I think it'll be all of next year, I think it'll be all of 26. Next 2.5 years are going to be chock full of dealing with the underside of the market. The good side of the market's going
to. I would agree with that, Bob. And to add more to that, higher rates just simply changed everything. The math has changed. It used to be LTV and debt yield as the sizing parameter. There's now a new constraint, and that's DSCR, which is debt service coverage ratio. More often than not, what this means, given the elevated rates, is that there's a shortfall at refi in terms of the available loan proceeds. Virtually every loan now requires a rebalancing, which is exactly what you're talking about. That can come in the form of equity being put in, that may or may not be available, subordinate debt or gap capital being raised, and it may push some asset sales as some loans need to be dealt with. Additionally, you made another point that bank balance sheets need to reduce, and the better assets will roll off. Assets need capital, and while the banks have stepped back, as we've been talking about, the CMBS markets, private capital and debt funds, and the life insurance companies have stepped in.
Yep. And it's always interesting to look through a period, an epoch of performance. So pre-GFC, when we worked together, we saw CMBS go from a relatively small market share to very large. It outgained market share from all the other sources of financing, right? And where did the problems hit when GFC? Bam, CMBS was right the crosshairs. Ooh. If you look at post-GFC, who had the hot hand? It wasn't CMBS, right? Their market share was kind of flattish. The big banks, the money center bank, wasn't them, because they already got drubbed during GFC. The financing source that had the hot hand post GFC with the regional banks. They almost doubled their market share from roughly 10, 11 to roughly low 20s, double. When that happens in commercial real estate, it's a very good indicator of where your next set of problems are likely to occur. And that's what we started seeing a year ago. And it's not done. We saw the three banks fail last year, but another one, Republic First, that quietly was failed last month. It wasn't a huge, right? It was $6 billion. You're going to see, I think, many more of those. There's well over 60 or 70 banks under $10 billion in assets that have more than 300% commercial real estate to Tier 1 capital. And that is the demarcation line the regulators use for danger, right? They're over that. So those are the ones that are probably most at risk as they deal with it. So
problems seem to be not totally, but disproportionately in regional banks. And the conduits have come back in terms of being able to issue new capital. And we're not seeing as many problems in the CMBS space as we did the last time. Is that because, in your experience, Tom, that maybe CMBS got a little bit more conservative post-GFC and were able to avoid some of those issues?
The CMBS market coming out of the GFC did adopt new underwriting standards, particularly around how underwritten cash flows were sized. The rating agencies, which rate these deals, revisited their methodologies. All of this led to better leverage, better cash flows, better capital structures. And from that perspective, CMBS is more resilient. Now, that's not to say that there are not certain CMBS deals which are under considerable pressure, which have been transferred to special servicing, and which are experiencing hardships, workouts, extensions, restructurings, and so on. So while the CMBS market has fared reasonably well, the default rates are within a reasonable band, it's not completely absolved from its risks.
Your qualification of a fully exonerating CMBS is spot on, I think, because CMBS, as we know, is a really slow lagging indicator, right? They're not a mark-to-mark balance sheet like banks can be. They're not regulated the same way. They don't have regulators walking their hallways, some of them mark their book. And two, they tend to have very long maturities, 10 years. So if you're a borrower and you're financed 3.5% coupon, even if you're underwater today, your financing is your lifeboat because it's in the money, a reciprocal amount. So I think it's hard to tell.
Tom, I was speaking to our good friend and colleague, James Milan, the other day, and we were talking about, is there a magic number out there for the cost of debt when the market really takes off? Now, we already mentioned that CMBS is already up 3x from what it was last year. There's liquidity for good deals. But is there a magic number, whether it be a 4% 10-year or otherwise, that you think will be the, aha, we're off to the races again, or is it a pretty liquid market now?
The credit spreads have come in materially, which is largely a function of investors seeing historically higher yields relative to the risk that they're taking. We've seen the market come to a complete grind given the recent Treasury volatility when it hits upwards of 4.5%, 5%. But as the yields fall, the longer-term yields fall below that 4.5% mark, and particularly as they trend towards 4%, the markets become wide open from a liquidity perspective, and that's borrower demand looking to lock in those rates as well as demand from lenders.
Where are you seeing some of the best opportunities today from Lone Star's perspective?
Well, it's still a bit early on the debt side, but if supported by facts first rather than opinion, if $200 billion last year couldn't refi and is in overtime this year, and it's likely to have a similar or greater amount this year, there is no question that debt is going to be the most sizable and consequential investment opportunity since GFC. It's going to be huge. We haven't seen it be huge yet outside of the failed banks, and that's because banks, servicers, real estate funds, they're quantifying it, and they're trying to figure out what their loss exposure is, and they're trying to reserve against it. Those things take time. They will happen. So, yes, I think it's going to be a big opportunity, but it's still fairly early because from the time Lehman went down, right, in September 08, till we saw real meaningful activity of portfolios, that would have been early 11. I mean, it was 2.5 years, right? So we're just about 2 years since rates started to go up, and it wasn't even the big 75 rate bump, so we're still on the early side of that.
So Tom, what are some of the asset types you're really active on right now?
Sure. Liquidity is strong for asset classes that have strong performance and strong fundamentals. And in today's market, that includes industrial logistics, it includes multifamily, it includes data centers, particularly powered shells, self-storage, as well as select hotel and retail assets that have performed well. Liquidity is currently more limited for other asset types, such as office, as well as life sciences.
Life sciences was the hot asset class probably 3 years ago. It wasn't that long ago. So what happened there, Bob?
I think that there was an excitement, euphoria over the VC, right? The unicorn, you're going to go public. And this is a tenant that will create a lot of liquidity. If you're buying it, you're trading it, the value will go up. But what happened was very few of those panned out. Many of them were unable to make that leap. So you're stuck with tenants that are either not in operation or space that's not being fully utilized. And that space is very, very technical, and it's very expensive to go find another user for it.
Tom, we obviously want to focus on the new deals, liquid markets, but we can't do all of that today. What is the best advice you'd give to our borrowers today that have an asset that's on the cusp, not one that's greatly underwater, but one that's sort of like neutral today? What should they be doing if their loan's coming due in the next 2 to 3 years?
Yeah, I think those transactions that are a little bit more cuspy, I've really been seeing a variety of outcomes there. There have been combinations of extensions, modifications, restructurings. Some of those have involved minor cash-ins. I've seen AB note splits to inject new equity at an agreeable basis. I've seen sourcing of new capital or subordinate capital for particular deals. And then there are simply those situations where there's a deed in lieu of foreclosure or a short sale if there's no longer an economic incentive to carry that asset.
How would you gauge the optimism of our average customer client today in mid-2024 versus where they were a year ago?
Improved, moderate improvement. What we're seeing today is there's actually fairly good depth for stabilized value add, bridge to perm, construction, all of course dependent on having the right asset. The more important consideration for debt liquidity isn't really the investment type as much as it is just the property type, the asset quality, the strength of that sponsor, and the market location. And so if you're one of those deep-pocketed sponsors that has a lot of wherewithal, you're feeling quite better about the markets and the depth of the market and liquidity and the cost of capital compared to where we were just 12 months ago.
So same question to you, Bob, but I want you to put on your GFC hat. How does this feel today versus how we felt, call it 2010, 2 years into the GFC?
Listen, there are some clear and unavoidable parallels. And those are, one, the overvaluation of assets. Two, the overleveraging of those overvalued assets. The trouble is going to be most pronounced where those who were paying the highest price, most exposed to those overprices, and then using abundant overleveraging, short dated, right? That's like the triple play. Unlike GFC, this is not systemic, right? We don't have the big banks, right? Citi or Wells Fargo, Wachovia, where I came from, right? We didn't fail, but we fell into the arms of Wells Fargo, right? We don't have a Lehman. So it's not the same. But in commercial real estate, there is a meaningfully or significant part of the set of the space where it's eerily similar. Way overvalued, way overleveraged. Now it's due and you're stuck. And like I said before, it's not the whole market, but it is $200 billion, didn't pay off last year, right? So if that's your run rate, right, over the next 3 years, right, you have $600 billion you're dealing with, just simple math. It's not the whole market, but it's a big part of it. And at some point, that needs to turn, that needs to liquefy. So I think it takes the next couple and a half years, but I think you're going to start seeing it because lenders, you follow the quarterly call reports of banks, the regionals, they're building up their reserves every quarter. They're fattening up the loan loss reserves. And once they do, you know what's going to happen. Bam, they're going to hit the release valve and sell and get rid of the stuff the regulators want to get rid of. And then they'll fill it again. They'll do that for 6 or 8 quarters till they clear the decks.
Another important lesson from the GFC that's applicable today is just the value of liquidity. And I learned that early in my career in the run-up to the GFC, sitting shoulder to shoulder with you, Bob, being on the front lines of distributing paper and seeing that liquidity evaporate and subject to big market moves, absolute whipsaws in the market, and what became ultimately a very frozen financing market. Particularly big banks that have big mark-to-market books, they learn these lessons from the GFC, and they certainly remember them well today. And that is that liquidity is paramount in risk-taking, particularly for banks and other lenders that warehouse loans in mark-to-market books. The importance of liquidity is just as applicable today as investors are seeking debt to capitalize acquisitions, manage their maturity schedules, as well as lenders that are managing the risk that they have on their own books.
And I think an important point to that is while there is quite a bit of dry powder today, I wouldn't say that that's tantamount to liquidity. The dry powder is going to be looking at value and return from where we are today. And if a deal or borrower is underwater, they're not going to sign up to take them and just trade places and say, hey, now I'm underwater. Oh, that feels pretty good. No one's going to do that. They're going to figure out where that should be properly valued and marked today. And then, oh, you'll have dry powder to go in there. But it doesn't turn, doesn't clear itself until you get that proper market value. And that's what we're struggling through right now.
Tom, I just want to turn to you. Who else is out there today? Is it sovereign wealth funds? Is it high net worth individuals? Are there some banks that are out there? Who? Walk me through where the depth of liquidity is and isn't today in the capital markets.
It's nearly all private capital. There's been a huge pullback from the core funds. There's been a pullback from the REITs. New funds that have been raised, this encompasses a big chunk of the dry powder. The sovereigns have been very active, taking advantage of market dislocation, elevated yields in which they can acquire some of these assets. Life insurance companies for very high quality, core A+, will look to add some exposure. So that's really the bulk of where the liquidity in today's market's coming from.
We're going to now go through the forward-looking portion of today's discussion of what do we see over the next 2 years. I think, Bob, you did a great job saying, look, we've got basically a log jam of old loans, which are of questionable quality, that are going to log jam the market for the next 2.5 years. Tom, what's your perspective? Next 2.5 years, what do we see?
To me, the challenge of higher rates is one thing, but tremendous rate volatility just makes it harder for buyers and sellers to agree on anything. Investors and lenders, what they need more than anything is transparency in the markets, reduced rate volatility. I think that'll go a long way for setting price levels. And this has been difficult, just given limited investment sale activity as well as treasury market volatility. But as we've been talking about, the Fed pause has given debt providers more confidence to deploy at today's elevated yields. Liquidity and cost of capital has come in. And as a result, there's been some moderate improvement in acquisition activity and a more substantial uptick in refinance activity, particularly in the CMBS single asset, single borrower space. I also think, and just to complete this thought, there's a real bifurcation in real estate. Not all of it is painted with a broad brush, as you may see in the media. Everyone is aware that office has unique challenges, and taking office as an example, perhaps the mall sector is a reasonable guide or proxy for the office sector. You're going to see tiering and bifurcation in certain asset classes, and office is probably one of those. The B and C quality assets, you're going to see losses, but you're going to see the A quality assets hold their value. And then you have other performing sectors such as hospitality, where you've got a really strong consumer. You've got strong leisure demand driving rates and cash flows. You've got an uptick in urban hospitality. So you've got some real positive fundamentals going on with asset classes like hospitality, and perhaps the risk associated with that sector is just how sustainable is that demand.
And I think, got a couple of thoughts there. Rates. we all want them to come down. And it's hard to get the transparency we want because the Fed, they control the short end. They don't do nearly as much on the long end. And the Treasury's at the bit of a box canyon because our deficits are so high. They need to issue lots of debt. So over the in the month of May, we had 2, 5, 7, and 10-year note auctions that all did worse than the when-issued market, meaning they cleared the yield was worse than the immediately preceding yield level. That's a bad sign. That's telling you that the market needs to be paid more than what it was before to take your new supply. Two, the bid-to-cover ratio was also very weak, meaning there were fewer people raising their hands saying, hey, man, count me in. I want some of them bonds. They're like, so it constrains how much rates can come down because just the quantity of debt we've amassed as a country. And that we haven't had in our lifetimes, right? Back to World War II, which none of us around for. But I think that is playing a role that commercial real estate and no risk asset is going to be able to figure out. But it's out there. Our debt to GDP is well north of 100% now. Most of the G7 countries, it's worse. It may mean you're 10 years just a bit higher than it's been historically, which isn't great for that transparency, because I think that transparency is thinking, hey, I'm 4.5 now, but I'm going back to 3.5, right? Three, anyone?
I think, you
that
know,
may not be there by the quantum of debt we have out there.
And I think to answer your question, take it another step further, Spencer. What all this really boils down to is the adjustment to the higher rate environment. It's going to take some time. This value adjustment period, this could take years for certain asset classes. And it's important to remember, commercial real estate is a cyclical business. 20 years ago, when Bob and I were at Wachovia together, the focus by lenders and investors was big office towers and regional malls. Today, we're talking about industrial logistics and data centers. I think it's just a great reminder that the markets are cyclical.
And I think the other thing about commercial real estate that we don't think enough of as an industry of practitioners is the role of, I'll hold my cell phone here, technology. Right, commercial real estate has really been transformed by technology. That's what led to the death of retail and the rationalization of malls. It's the same thing that's happening to office, right? Technology forward office buildings, well located, newer with the amenities, what people want. The old stuff that don't have it, they're dying. But it's affecting all commercial real estate. So because of that, the capital requirements are higher. And the life cycle, I believe, is getting shorter than it historically has been, right? Because these quantum leaps in technology happen more frequently and the cost to adopt them are more considerable. So I think that's something that we have to factor into in our investments in commercial real estate.
I think one other thing, this is not anti-technology, but this is just an observation of where the institutional grade real estate is. The location is changing. It's not changing by city necessarily, because New York will always come back. LA will always come back. San Francisco will always come back. It'll just come back in different neighborhoods. And those neighborhoods are the ones that have live, work, play. They have infrastructure. They have wealth. We have this new report coming out called Shaping Tomorrow's Cities, which talks all about the fact that these big cities aren't going anywhere. They're just going to move neighborhoods on where some of the best institutional quality real estate's going to be.
Thoroughly agree with you. Absolutely.
As a final thought, what are the tactics for success we're giving our clients today?
Yeah, we're coming off of 2023, which was the biggest year ever for bank failures. And today's market feels substantially better. As we talked about earlier, there is a real path towards a healthier capital markets, towards better liquidity, a better rate environment. So where we are today, there's an abundance of opportunities. And investors are picking through a lot of those opportunities. And that doesn't come without a significant amount of risk in today's market. There remains risk on the rates and the inflation front. That is a headline risk for investors. There is risk on geopolitical side. We have conflicts in the Middle East and in Eastern Europe. These are all macroeconomic concerns that weigh on investors. But that being said, more broadly speaking, there may not be any better time than now to make generational buys, acquire good assets at deeply discounted prices, Leverage and financing is becoming more available and from more capital sources. That's coming from CMBS, life companies, private capital, selectively from banks, and the GSEs, as we talked about, for multifamily are open. So between the depth of the market, improving liquidity, the outlook is quite positive.
Bob, last question to you. You see everything, given that you have such a wide breadth of what your mandate is for Lone Star. You also have Hudson Advisors, which is one of the largest asset managers in the business. What do you, and you have partners that are your asset owners that Lone Star invests in. What are you telling them for success today and over the long term?
Well, I'd say a bit philosophically, making returns is always difficult. It's only in hindsight does the answer look obvious, but you never have the benefit of that right when you're in it. It's an effort where it favors the informed and the diligent, right? And your pedigree matters a lot less, right? Because each deal is that new opportunity to get it right or not or pass. So I'd say just the commercial real estate is unelegant. It's the gritty determination of being informed and being really diligent to boil down those opportunities that you think have very attractive total return potential from where you sit today. And you've got to divorce that a little bit from what it was in the past, because the past is not prologue. It doesn't mean it will happen again. I'd say the informed and the diligent, and candidly, that's what we try and practice at Lone Star and Hudson, you know, every day.
Well, I think if I were to summarize this podcast in one word, I'd summarize it by saying today. And that people need to be laser beam focused on today. Not yesterday, not tomorrow, today, using reasonable assumptions to get the best risk-adjusted return. So on behalf of the Weekly Take, I want to thank our two friends, starting with Tom Rugg, Vice Chairman, Co-Head of U.S. Large Loans. Tom, thanks for coming out. Great job.
Thanks again, Spencer. Appreciate it.
Great job. And our old friend and client and former colleague of Tom's, Bob Ritchie, Senior Managing Director of Lone Star Funds. Thank you for coming out.
Spencer, thank you very much. And thank you, everyone.
If you're interested in more on the state of the real estate capital markets, check out our website, cbre.com/theweeklytake. And also look for other episodes in which we follow the money in our business, including conversations about deal flows and investments across sectors and markets. You can find those wherever you get your podcasts. And if you subscribe to the show or follow us on LinkedIn, you won't miss a beat. You can also find the report we mentioned, Shaping Tomorrow's Cities, on our website. And stay tuned for some bonus content we've got in the hopper to share later this week. We hope your summer is off to a great start and look forward to keeping you informed with lots of new episodes coming soon, including a special one for you road warriors out there featuring the Points Guy, a look at travel loyalty programs, AI, and hotel real estate, and lots of other great shows as well. Thanks as always for tuning in. I'm Spencer Levy. Be smart, be safe, be well.